Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 148 of the Life Endurance Podcast. I'm here with my friend Vincent Batista. He's a recent PhD from the University of Michigan, what I like to call my genetics guy. Today we're talking about mainly stuff I find interesting, but probably human evolution, paleoanthropology, and human genetics. You might remember Vincent from episode 114. Did I read that wrong? Did I say 114 before?
Probably. No, you're good.
I didn't? Okay. 148. Yeah. Connor and Carlton aren't here today, so we're freeballing it. Yeah. So anyway, episode 148, you might have seen Vinny on episode 114, but you know, here we are on 148 now. So we're going to talk. Vincent, how you doing?
Good. How you doing?
I'm all right.
I enjoy freeballing. That's Tom Petty's famous song.
You're a classic rock guy, aren't you?
Big classic rock guy.
Okay. You like fishing, you like dogs, and you like classic rock.
You know, it's, I'm a man with very simple hobbies, and they are beer, canids, and fly fishing.
I appreciate the canids and not canids, bro.
Yeah, like coyotes. We're big coyote guy.
You're a big coyote guy?
Big coyote guy.
You do send me a lot of stuff in reference to your dog looking at coyotes. You want to dive into that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I have a livestock guardian dog rescue named Mac. He was a runt of his litter. He's 120 pounds when he's lean. He's a brick shit house. Yeah, he's great. You know, I take him with me when I go fishing and everything. And obviously New England has a really wild coyote problem right now.
Where's that?
It's all over New England. It's wild.
Oh, New England.
Gotcha. Yeah. Like they brought in sharpshooters a couple towns over and it like didn't help with the coyote problem. It's like, guys, get some wildlife biologists over here. Like talk to them about how like, you know, the landscape is contributing to this. But yeah, Mac is a big fella. You know, these livestock guardian dogs are bred to not really have a prey drive. They, you know, are very gentle with livestock and stuff. And we think he was raised on a chicken farm because we have pictures of him as a puppy on a chicken farm.
Okay.
But he really loves ducks. He's like Tony Soprano.
Or Hugh Neutron.
Yeah. He just loves ducks and birds, and he, you know, but he can distinguish between like predatory birds and non-predatory birds. So he sees a hawk, like a red-tailed hawk, he bugs out at it. But he sees like a mallard, and he's perfectly fine. But
that's like a scent thing or a chemical thing.
No, I genuinely think it's like aerial, like an animal that's like circling above your head. You know what I mean? These dogs are great because like they, you know, they can sense. All dogs can smell way better than we can, hear way better than we can. And so they detect things in the landscape more easily than we do. Like I took him fishing up in the Green Mountain National Forest, and he sits next to me when we fish. He's usually off leash, or, you know, I have the leash dropped next to me or whatever. But he just booked it up this riverbank and he treed a black bear. He like had this, he just like did not care. And this is like pretty common. I called him off. He was fine. But like, you know, here in Massachusetts, the coyotes are to the point where like I take him with me on purpose because they come up to you. They just do not care. They'll just approach you. And they've like bitten people on the beach.
Black bears?
No, coyotes.
Coyotes.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine a black bear?
I was like, I feel like I'd heard about that.
Yeah.
I should have.
Nah. There's definitely black bears over here, but the coyotes are really what's the big thing. And there's, you know, if you ever read the book Coyote America, that's a really good book if you're interested in that stuff.
I haven't.
It's by Dan Flores is the name of the author. Basically, the whole thesis is like coyotes are a good model for humans.
Okay. It's funny you bring that up too, because one of the things I wanted to ask you about when I get into species later is about coyotes. But also, you said that they're a big issue in New England. I see my aunt sends me pictures sometimes of coyotes on Long Island all the time. Yeah. And I've seen several pictures on like Long Island Wise Guy on Instagram of like just coyotes like roaming suburbs now. And that wasn't usually a thing when I was a kid in the 90s. So it's like they're populating a lot now.
They're all over the place, man. They're everywhere. The only place in Massachusetts where they aren't is like Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket. They're everywhere now. But yeah, in Connecticut growing up, you know, you'd see one every once in a while. But like I see one all the time. Like one of them killed a buck behind my in-law's place last year.
One coyote?
So I was probably a pack, but they took down a buck that had recently shed its antlers. They took it down like right behind the house. And it happened first thing in the morning. We heard it. And I went and walked my dog back there, and he was going nuts, man. He was freaking out. He found the carcass. He like peed all over it. He disappeared in the woods, came back with like its heart in his mouth. I'm like, Mac, drop that. Like, what the hell are you doing? It was nuts, man.
Sounds like something I would do.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool, though. One thing I find fascinating is coyotes, for sure. They are Canis. Is their species Canis, or Canis latrans is their species. Canis is a genus. But dogs are Canis lupus, familiaris, wolves are Canis lupus. You're the guy who always comments on our Instagram posts, like, what even is a species, man? And like, you and I think, vibe pretty well on this idea. So I had a friend, it might even be from that book. My friend had told me it was from a book she read, that coyotes are just natural dogs. Like they're a wolf species that just exists as natural dogs. Whether you want to go with that behaviorally or genetically, obviously they're different. But her point was like, they just fulfill a niche that they scavenge, right? And they do little things like that.
Yeah.
They're not exactly like apex hunters like wolves are, but they're not dogs entirely. But my question to you is like, it's all just one species to me that does different specialized niches, isn't it? Or niches? I don't know, like how you would define species in that way.
Here's the thing is that they mix with wolves. So the coyotes in the east are actually an admixed group of coyotes from further west and wolves. So, I mean, even to call them a species would be, you know.
Misnomer.
Well, I mean, like, yeah. Like, I mean, if they mix, they don't, you know, they're ecologically, they're their own thing for sure. I mean, but also they have so many different ecologies. This is why they're like canids are a good model to talk about humans, because like people say, oh, Neanderthals, like, well, which Neanderthal? You know, they probably lived in North Africa, they lived in England, they survived for, you know, as we knew them, for, you know, 100,000 years or longer. Which ecology are you talking about? You know what I mean? Like, that's the same thing with coyotes. You have coyotes out west, you have coyotes in New York City, you know what I mean? So
right,
depending on which ecology you want to talk about, yeah, no, they're interesting critters for sure.
So species to you, I know it's kind of a hard ask, but and guys, for everyone listening here, like what we were going to talk about today was human evolution and paleoanthropology, but this applies to any zoological creature. Like, what would you define as species? And I know that's a loaded question.
That's tough. I could tell you what a species isn't, probably.
Let's do
a little
that.
Bit more easily. So a species isn't something that somebody invents so they can get tenure. That's the first way of talking about it. So, like, taking a step back from that, like, I understand and appreciate the value of calling something a species for conservation reasons. If you can call a local population of orangutan its own species in order to save that local population of orangutans, I will be the first person to call it species with you. Whether or not it meets a genetic definition of species is a different story. So there's different sorts of species definitions, from an ecological species to a biological species, whatever. But I think if you ask 20 biologists how to define species, you'll get 20 different answers. And for probably equally good reasons. I mean, well, as it applies to humans, human fossils specifically, you know, people will describe a new species in the genus Homo, right? And they'll say, oh, this species of Homo, you know, XYZ falls in between Homo XYZ minus one and XYZ plus one. You know what I mean? And it's like, well, first of all, one, how do you know that? Second of all, the radiometric dating isn't that high enough resolution. You don't have a good age range for it. You also can't tell me if this is a male or a female or a juvenile. Like, a lot of the times, the way that, especially in the past, people called species was, it was basically following what we do with dinosaurs, where it's like basically every fossil gets a species name, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Which isn't to say that there aren't species of humans. Like, if somebody were to say to me that like Homo naledi was a species, I'd say that's okay. Yeah, if you want to call it a species, you can call it a species. But if somebody were to say that Homo habilis, Homo ergaster, Homo rudolfensis, Homo erectus were four different species of human, I'd be like, I don't really know if I buy that. You know what I mean? You have a huge spectrum of variation of humans that we can call Homo, and especially if they're living around the same period of time and in the same places, you have to prove that they were not able to breed with one another. And I don't think you can really do that. You know what I mean? You could probably say that like the Paranthropus lineage was distinct from the stuff that turned into us. Like, that's probably a fair argument, but I wouldn't say that they were, you know, that they couldn't interbreed with any other human population. And that's like a very strict biological species definition. A lot of this go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Would you agree with the idea then that species is like any organism that can interbreed and have viable offspring?
Well, you know, because then coming at it as a geneticist, like, there are things that I would call species that produce viable offspring. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I don't know. And it's like, it's really difficult. So I think you need to just have, especially when it comes to ancient humans, the null hypothesis is that groups are the same and you have to prove that they're different. It takes fewer assumptions to say that they're the same and puts the onus on the actual science and makes you actually have to do the work to prove that species are different. And, you know, and also not everything needs to have a biological species definition. I think we put a lot of emphasis on nomenclature, and I understand the importance of that and I value that. But I also think at the same time, we really split hairs a lot. Like somebody tried telling me that the reason why Neanderthals and us were the different species was because we have chins. And like, come on, that's really what you're going to reduce the argument to, is that we have chins? Really? Like, come on, man. Like, I cannot buy that. Like, that one phenotype is the one. Like, come on. Also, Neanderthals had chins. You know what I mean? They weren't the crimson chin, but they had chins.
Sure. Shout out Fairly Odd Parents. Yeah, and I see those differentiations all the time. It's like they were shorter and stockier, or versus, like, you know, they hunted with thrusting spears and things like that versus atlatls. But that, to me, boils down to, I mean, obviously the phenotypical stuff is, what I'm trying to say is it's a cultural difference to me, usually, like through stone tools more so than it is a genetic difference. So,
yeah, I mean, especially because they all mixed with us in that, you know what I mean? They mixed with what we would call Denisovans, even though the Denisovans probably never called themselves Denisovans. Neanderthals never called themselves Neanderthals, you know what I mean? These people were more concerned with just surviving the winter than anything else, right? They didn't care about populational labels and stuff. But yeah, no, I mean, I would agree with you. I mean, I would not say that Neanderthals went extinct. They changed, right? But Neanderthalism is probably more of a starting to think when you say Neanderthal, everybody knows what you mean.
Right.
That's also a whole different sets of assumptions, but like that lifestyle changed, evolved as these groups were absorbed by other groups migrating in and out of Africa and the Near East and things like that. So yeah, I mean, like, then you could say they went extinct in the same way that Mycenaean Greeks went extinct, or the Vikings went extinct, you know, like the lifestyle went extinct, the gene pool changed.
Yeah.
It was still, I mean, we still descend from then, but you know, they didn't disappear like that. You know what I mean?
Huh. Long story short is humans are super admixed in the past and in the present. And it's really difficult to say, without having boots on the ground of a time machine, what population dynamics were like. And that's why paleogenomics exists, because we're trying to reconstruct that stuff. But yeah, that's that.
What is paleogenomics, by the way?
Genomics of the past. So
okay, so
yeah, it's not just humans either. So like, yeah, paleogenomics can be woolly rhino, Neanderthal, Labrania, you know, maybe anything.
Sure. What's the difference between genomics and genetics?
Genetics is like, when I think of genetics as a field, I'm specifically speaking about the study of genes. Right.
Okay.
That can be whatever you want. Genomics is the study of the structure, the function, the mapping of genomes, how the genomes evolve, and all that other stuff. So they overlap, obviously. But, you know, when you talk about genomics, you're talking about the genome. Mm. When you talk about genetics, you're talking about genes, which is, you know, people use them interchangeably. I use them interchangeably all the time. They don't mean the same thing. But.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that's a good spot to end the first segment, and then we'll pick back up afterwards. I got a few questions about what you're doing.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, welcome back to episode 148 of the Life Learns podcast. I'm here with my friend Vincent Batista. We're talking paleogenomics, paleogenetics. We just discussed what genomics and genetics are. I don't think I got to ask you last segment, but what is it you're currently doing for work?
The last time we spoke, I was at Massachusetts General Hospital. And
that's
I was
right.
In the Center for Translational Epidemiology, which was in GI. And I since finished just kind of like a non-traditional postdoc. And I finished that and got a job in industry where I do translational epidemiology for a company called Bristol Myers, which is a pharmaceutical company.
Okay. So yeah. We're allowed to call that big pharma.
You can call it whatever you want. Yeah. It's a very, very small, very, very small group. And we do a lot of really cool stuff. I personally need to do some cool things. So.
Yeah. How do you feel doing that, having gone through 3 degrees of anthropology and not teaching like anthropology?
I do anthropology every day.
Yeah.
I get to use my degree in my training every single day. Every single day.
And you're not doing musical chairs of training students and giving degrees and stuff?
I still get to mentor young scientists. I get to mentor people from a bunch of different backgrounds from all over the world. I get to work with people from all over the world. And I get to use my training as an anthropologist. I also want to say, like, you know, I was an archaeologist as an undergrad, but then I got a bioanthro degree from a four-field school. And that meant that I had to take everything from a genetics course to an osteology course to, which I did both of those for my dissertation, to doing computational methods, to taking medical anthropology. And I use that stuff all the time. I even use linguistic anthropology all the time. Like talking about power dynamics, talking about the language of consent, talking about these things. I use that all the time. And I don't have a whole lot of colleagues that are at this stage in their career where they get to do that all like every day. And I do it literally every day.
That is so cool, man.
Yeah.
And when you say consent, you mean like for like research purposes, genetics purposes?
Yeah. And like, you know, we might, for example, on a given day, be speaking with stakeholders about, you know, like what, I can't really go into too much detail because a lot of it's proprietary, sure. But like, say we were hypothetically getting a project off the ground with a community, you know, making sure that the research questions that are directly relevant to their specific health outcomes are being met and that they're informed and knowing that this is done in a sustainable way. And like, you know, like I haven't been there that long, but people that I work with, there's actually like several people who have anthropology background in my department.
Really?
Yeah. Who are bioinformaticians. Cool. Yeah. So, yeah.
What's your day-to-day look like there? Like as, say, like for someone who's anthropologically interested?
I do a lot of writing computer programs.
Huh.
So my dissertation, my PhD research was on, it was computational biology. I mean, I did genetics and I did physiology and anatomy. And so I was pretty light on the physiology stuff because I was looking at genes implicated in known physiological processes. So I didn't do a lot of hands-on physiology stuff. But in my postdoc training, I did a lot of proteomics. So for my day-to-day, I might do some proteomic stuff, some population genetic stuff, which is what I'm really familiar with, to writing machine learning programs to help refine stuff or, you know, doing code reviews, things like that. I do a lot of writing also, like writing up white papers for new disease areas that we might be interested in. Things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
How do you feel about machine learning and AI going into the future
if you don't mind me asking.
I do machine learning all the time, and it's a really powerful tool. The problem with powerful tools in science is that people think they will save the world. And people who do machine learning and AI know that it's an important tool, but also know the limitations. But people who want to fund a lot of the research, I'm not saying my company, but I'm saying like NSF things that I've seen, NIH things that I've seen, are promising you the moon and stars when you could get to the moon and stars with conventional statistics. Like, you could do things with, from your Stat 101, Stat 201 classes. You don't need machine learning. So that's one thing. On the other hand, machine learning is going to really help us to be able to identify possibly new therapies. It could help us to learn things from orphan drugs, like drugs that were developed but never brought to market, for example. Mm-hmm. It's going to help us identify new things from diagnostic imaging. These are all things that are being published right now in high-impact journals that, like, you know, people are using this to make a positive influence on human health. And I think I suffer from being an optimist, but this could, you know, AI could be something that leads us to a 4-day work week, you know, or a 3-day work week. You know, if we get our stuff together, you know, we could spend more time, you know, doing the other important things in our day to day. But, you know, again, I'm a futurist optimist person, so, but I got to reel that.
No, you're good.
It's nice to dream. Yeah.
Yeah. I see it every day, and I want to get back to genetics here in a minute, but like my friend's an engineer. He loves AI because it can like, he can type in stuff and he'll let the program run for like 24 hours and he'll have this like really cool computer thing that he designed or like a product he designed and it comes out looking super cool. But then there's also the, like I would love to use artwork for AI, but like, or AI for artwork, but I don't want to plagiarize people's art that it's taking from and things like that, which is a bummer.
That's a huge problem.
A big thing too is like, any kid now can use ChatGPT and type in like, make me a YouTube video about the history of dogs. And like, I did it and it took some straight up quotes from my Instagram, some of Angela's work and just like put it right there. And then they can make a video, which is great. I want kids to be able to be creative, but like, it's just scary to me that you can just do that. But it's also a cool tool, like you said. So
I'm glad that it wasn't a big thing when I was teaching.
All the cheating and tests and classes.
Well, also, like, I think... But also like in anthropology, at least what I was teaching, there was so much in class stuff, like lab practicals and stuff that you can't ChatGPT your way out of.
Right.
The other thing is like having students be like write personal reflections, things like that. In person, you can't really ChatGPT that either, right? So like having introspection, like that sort of stuff is really important. And I think, you know, it's definitely a windfall in what we do, but I think you know, we'll find a way. AI is cool though. AI is super cool. Like, I think we're going to be able to use AI to build like better, safer automobiles and, you know, things like that. So that'll be sweet.
I'm glad you're optimistic about it. I see a lot of people who aren't, but I also think it's got more positive than negative, I think, currently.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting back to genetics, I would love to chat to you about that forever. But in genetics, I understand. Well, actually, I think we might have mentioned this on our last episode. I got in contact with you because you reached out to me about a Neanderthal post that I had.
Yeah.
And you had said something to me on there that like, hey, you're not entirely accurate about this. And instead of like getting pissed, I was like, oh, wait, this guy's right. Who are you? And then I realized you were my teacher's student.
Yeah.
And I was
we're
like,
kin,
oh,
dude.
Okay.
We're kin.
We are kin. So like I immediately listened to you more. So that being said, we have the same background of information on out of Africa versus multi-regional, but would you be able to explain what out of Africa is?
So out of Africa and multi-regionalism are two contrasting models of human origins. So out of Africa says modern humans, the way we are today, appeared in Africa and we replaced populations that were outside of Africa, right? So multi-regionalism, if we want to contrast the two, says that humans, the earliest humans on record, earliest hominids on record, appear in Africa. There were primates outside of Africa, but the first things that we know were things that led to us appear in Africa, and they disperse outside of Africa. And even within and without Africa, you have core and peripheral populations. You have population centers and population edges. And these populations are connected through migration and gene flow between them. And something that's advantageous in one place will become higher and higher in frequency until fixation in that specific region. And if it's even beneficial to other regions, it'll, because of migration, spread throughout the planet, right? And essentially it says that populations like Neanderthals or the hominids that you find in East Asia, they didn't go extinct in the way that, you know, we replace them. But in actuality, we mix with them. And the evidence for that is that traits that we see in ancient human populations in specific parts of the world can be found in their descendants who live in those parts of the world today. Now, the support for the out of Africa is that if you look at mitochondrial DNA and YSTR, so like the Y chromosomal DNA, these things coalesce in Africa. And none of the ancient DNA that we've gotten from Neanderthals or other humans that are, you know, Denisovans, whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
None of those uniparentally inherited markers from antiquity are found in humans today. Right? So like both arguments have their merits, but I come from an academic tradition that tends towards this multi-regional braided stream idea of human evolution. And the evidence of that, since we started sequencing Neanderthal genomes, and not just their mitochondrial DNA, is that we find pretty alarming amount of Neanderthal and Denisovan ancestry in living human populations. And as was predicted by this multi-regional model, traits that were advantageous to certain places in the world in antiquity, where there was a geographic center of humans, let's say Denisovans, can be found in descendant populations today. For example, genes that allow people who live in high altitude regions to survive at high altitude in the Himalayas, those haplotypes can be actually traced back to Denisovans who lived in those same areas. So we see other things like certain Neanderthal related traits that we believe contribute to body proportionality and things like that. So essentially, the big difference between the two, which these competing camps in the back and in the past thought, was like either all humans were replaced or all humans mixed, and reality is somewhere in between the two of those. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes there is this argument about multi-regionalism that says that it's this like model of actually the candelabra, which was a model put forward by guys like Carlton Coon. I believe it was Carlton Coon. Basically said that you have distinct human species and these species never mixed. And people from East Asia are the same species as people from East Asia from a million years ago. People from Africa are the same as people from Africa a million years ago. People from Europe are the same as people from Europe a million years ago, and they don't mix. And that's often what people think of because they are given this incorrect model of multi-regionalism, when in reality, the underlying assumption of multi-regionalism, the thing that makes the model work, is that humans mix, and they mixed in the past similar to how they mix today. And I believe the second that we found any Neanderthal DNA in living populations today, it showed that multi-regionalism has merit, and it's true. I mean, we see genes from Neanderthals in North African populations that isn't from, like, post-Bronze Age population expansion into North Africa from people from Eurasia. Like, there were probably Neanderthals in the Middle East and North Africa. You know, there were Neanderthals in the Levant. They were, you know, they probably moved around. They probably, why would they in stop? Yeah, they were in Spain too. Why would they stop when they got to, you know, Mount Sinai? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I like it.
Too nice over here.
Yeah. Damn. Okay. So you think it's a mix of the two then? Like out of Africa and, well, I guess you can't have one without the other.
I adhere to the braided stream multi-regional idea insofar as humans mix. They have always mixed and they will always continue to mix. Mm-hmm. Out of Africa happened. It's a matter of if you think it happened 50,000 years ago or 2 million years ago.
Whoa. Okay.
Right? So we have Dimanisi, right? Dimanisi is in Georgia. It's an archaeological site that has five individuals that are attributed to Homo erectus. Right. And these, I think it's 1.75 million years, something like that. It's pretty old. It's older than 1.6 million years old. I don't remember the exact date. But long story short, these are five individuals. You have males and females. You have younger folks and older folks. And there is so much variation in this one population from this one cave site that it almost completely encompasses the variation that you see within Homo in Africa at that exact same period of time.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, as soon as they show up in Africa, they're in Europe and Asia. You know what I mean? Like they show up and then they're all over the place.
Homo erectus? Right?
Yeah. If that's what you want to call them. Yeah. You know, they show up and then they disperse, right? Born to run thing, right? Like they're like, yeah, you know what? it's like Forrest Gump, you know?
I just kept running.
Just kept running.
All right, let's cut that there, and then in the next segment, I want to ask you more about that. And just for the record, we're talking about Georgia, Hezbollah, Asia. We're not talking about Georgia, Tennessee, Florida. No, Georgia, America. That's the word. There we go. All right, we'll be right back.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, welcome back to episode 148 of a Life Nerds podcast. I just want to clear one thing up. Last segment, I mentioned Hezbollah is from Georgia. Hezbollah is actually from Dagestan, which is not Georgia. Very different former satellite states of the Soviet Union. Anyway, we're talking with Vincent about I want to get into Homo erectus. Now, that area you're talking about in Georgia made me think about this, but I often tell people that humans are... we're just mutant Homo erectus. Like once we reached Homo erectus and made Acheulean hand axes and that tool industry, we've kind of just interbred with other variants of humans and we are what we are today. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, that's basically, I mean, so that site in Georgia, Dimonisi, it's interesting because when the first archaeological finds, well, the first human remains were found there, there was, I think, four individuals, and they tried to call it Homo georgicus. They wanted it to be its own species. And then a couple of years later, they found a fifth individual, and that fifth individual was interesting because the variation that you have in these five individuals almost completely encompasses all the variation you see for contemporaneous members of the genus Homo in Africa. And it's about 1.8 million years old, this site. So to me, to say that we are all different versions of Homo erectus is fine. I mean, you know, I don't know if you would take, you know, a 2-million-year-old Homo erectus and drop him off in New York City today. Some people would be like, oh, okay, this guy looks a little bit different, right? Or this person looks a little bit different. Like that could be the case. But especially for later Homo erectus, you know, they're really not that different from us. I mean, I don't think it was a case that there was like a speciation event. I don't think there was ever a clean break in the human lineage from the last Australopiths to the earliest members of the genus Homo up into us. It's a long and slow process evolution is. And some people are in favor of things of like, you know, a model where there's cladogenesis, where you have this branch that goes off and makes their own thing. It doesn't really seem to have been the case for us. Now, there are some unique populations of human, like Naledi, Mm-hmm. Naledi looks pretty different. It doesn't look like us necessarily. It doesn't look like Homo erectus necessarily either. It's its own population, and there's a remarkable amount of similarity between the individuals there. And what's weird is that they're only known from, like, you know, a small geographical area.
Yeah.
A cave site, right? So now if you compare Naledi, which is more recent, with Dimanisi, like, again, the variation in Dimanisi is incredible. You have males and females, you have younger folks, you have older folks, you have people that are healthy, you have folks with a lot of bone resorption and their teeth are missing from their mandible. You have one individual, a male, who is who has the biggest skull out of all of them, and he has the smallest brain, smallest endocranial volume out of all of them. So, you know, it's pretty interesting. But yeah, I mean, all human populations on the planet today, even though we have regional variation in the amount of ancestry derived from archaic human populations like Neanderthals, Denisovans, etc., the first Homo erectus that moved to East Asia met some really unique evolutionary selective pressures. The same with the first Homo erectus that went to Northwest Africa or ones that went to Iberia, right? Each one of these places would have had their own sets of pressures ranging from UV radiation to possibly high altitude to maybe even heat, maybe even hotter places than what they were like living in sort of a tropical environment, maybe in East Africa or South Africa, wherever you want to talk about. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. There's no clear break, no line in the sand that separates us from really any of our ancestors, because that's not really how evolution works.
Sure. Why do you think people are so hell-bent on, like, getting a line in the sand or, like, you know, wanting a clear,
yeah,
like,
missing link?
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's because we humans are weird because we like really simple explanations. Mm-hmm. And for some, evolution is a simple explanation, right? Like, things that are fit for an environment are going to have a greater likelihood of being passed on to subsequent generations. We, the lay public, on the other hand, this is like, you know, this is everybody. This isn't just people who are interested in science or not, whatever. Mm-hmm. We latch onto certain ideas from the past, and sometimes it takes a long time to unlearn these things. So you see, like, you know, the Ascent of Man or something like that, the cartoon of the chimp and then an early human and then some right. later human and then us, we have this idea that there's a missing link. But every time you find a missing link and you stick it into that lineage, a new gap opens up on either end. So there's something that will come before it and something that will come after it. And you, if you populate all those gaps with all the variation of humans, it's a big bushy tree with vines interconnecting them. And it's a really tangled bank, as Darwin called it. And if you follow the braided stream analogy of human evolution, it says that, you know, our genes that we have parts of our genome that evolved in places that are not where we live today, right? Like, mm-hmm. there are parts of our genome that evolved to selective pressures in East Africa. There are parts of our genome that evolved in maybe in the Near East or, you know, but as far as like a missing link goes, you know, I think it's a catch-all term. Because we expect there to be one thing that we can point to that can answer all our questions, and that's never going to be the case.
Yeah. What's the braided stream? I remember that in Human Origins.
But. Yeah, yeah. So it's like, it's multi-regionalism. It's basically that, I don't know who came up with the term braided stream. I think maybe Hawks may have. But essentially, it's that just like a glacial stream, that has these little rivulets that break off and reconnect. And and when they diverge, some of these divergent streams may disappear and evaporate, but other ones could pick up more steam and collect more meltwater, and they become bigger and they become a main stem of a stream. You will have this process of divergence and reticulation. And that seems to be the case for human evolution. For example, we have a population movement out of Africa into the Near East, and that population separated into Western Neanderthals, then Eastern Neanderthals, and Denisovans. And these different populations traded genes with each other. And you have things like local lineage loss. Like, there was a population turnover in Neanderthals that happened at one point in time, where you have Neanderthals from the East basically moving back into Western Europe. You know, Western Europe is where genes go to die. It's a cul-de-sac. And when you have things like glacial events happening, populations get stuck. You know, the gene pool gets smaller, populations become more inbred. And that's happened a billion zillion times in human evolution. But then, you know, if these populations survive, new populations will move in and mix with them and bring with them advantageous genetic variants. And we see that with early humans that look like us who go to Europe, they mix with Neanderthals and Denisovans. We see the same thing when they go into Central Eurasia, probably East Asia, Southeast Asia. It happens every time humans in the past moved somewhere, they mixed with whoever was there. And that kind of defies this model of a single dispersal with complete population replacement. It didn't happen like that. Populations mixed, and it seems like they always mix. It seems to be the rule more than anything else. Every ancient genome that we get has some level of admixture in it with archaic humans, with very few exceptions.
Is it possible that some of those like gene sequences that are more archaic are just still in the DNA, or is it pretty evident that it's admixture?
You can tell that there's admixture, yeah. So even though ancient DNA can be very degraded, because of this population, basically bifurcation that you get, you have these things evolving on their own, and they evolve kind of unique ancestry informative markers, right? So mutations that are unique to a place and a time that are then passed down to offspring. There's this, I guess you can call it a mathematical modeling process using these admixture algorithms where you can detect amounts of these ancestry components being crossed into populations. There's also a really simple test called ABBA-BABBA, where it's basically you have...
ABBA-BABBA.
Yeah, ABBA-BABBA. It's also called the D statistic. But basically, it's you have a test for deviation from like a very strict bifurcation event or a splitting event in evolutionary time. And long story short, if you have an excess of these mutations that are found in this, you know, archaic human population, inside your non-archaic population, chances are they were crossed in. So, you know, that's kind of oversimplification of it, but it's, you know, it's an interesting test.
So Neanderthals, just like kind of as you put it, like they were existing populations in Eurasia. How did they?
Probably North Africa, and probably North Africa too. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, they're a human group, and these humans left. There was a population dispersal from Africa sometime after 2 million years ago. We find the earliest evidence of this at Dmanisi, and there's some archaeological sites in China that are around the same age. So it looks like as soon as they got out of Africa, they probably went back into Africa, probably went into maybe what is today the, you know, Saudi Arabia, that area, probably went into India and East Asia, probably went all over the place. But we do find archaeological signatures in Georgia. We find early human remains in Iberia over 1 million years ago. So, you know, they move into these places and they put down roots and then they evolve to local selective pressures. And so like we have the Atapuerca hominids who are over 1 million years old. I think the earliest evidence of a human there, like osteologically, is a tooth. Yeah, I think the oldest individual there is a tooth at Sima. I'm not 100% sure. You have to fact check that. But, you know, we have ancient DNA from those individuals too. And we see that, like, I think their mitochondrial genome is more closely related to Denisovans than it is to the Neanderthals who lived in Spain after them. But I think their Y lineage is more closely related to the Neanderthals. That might be backwards. It's been, you know, 6 or 7 years, maybe longer than that, since I last read these papers. But yeah, no, it's interesting. But what you do see is that you have the formations of basically a population structure of these Western hominids and these Eastern hominids, and probably multiple Eastern hominids. The ones that are in Southeast Asia might look a little bit different. But realistically, like East Asia in China was probably a population center, like the Chukchi and Jokochen. I don't know what the proper pronunciation is. Like you have a whole lot of individuals living there. And like the last ones of them, they're called like the late Homo erectus, and they could have been around, you know, less than 100,000 years ago, but you know, they were mixing with humans that are moving there all the time. They're constantly mixing. So
that's where they found fire too, right? Like,
I think we were using fire at least by 1 million years ago, to be honest with you.
But yeah, I would agree with that statement too.
I don't know how we could, like, as a person who studied cold climate adaptation, I don't really know how we could have moved into all these places without fire.
Exactly. Like even at night in the Middle East, it's still cold. Like,
oh yeah, yeah, the desert is cold, man.
Colder. That's fascinating too. And fire too is more, that's something I always looked at as a marker of like, okay, 1 million years ago, fire. It's like a education or an intellectual thing, but it's not. It's literally just a technology, much like Levua technology or actually in technology.
Yeah.
It might take a little more fine motor skill to make a bow drill, but like,
you know. I mean, that's assuming they were making bow drills. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Just hitting flint together or doing a
thing. Who knows? Like even if they found naturally occurring. Yeah. I mean but managing that resource and protecting that resource as fire, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, even in Australia, there's possibly evidence of burning, intentionally managing the landscape with fire, like as soon as Aboriginal Australian ancestors get there. There's some evidence for that. So, yeah. So, I mean, even, you know, at 50,000 years ago, people are using fire in the way that we use fire today. So,
Yeah. And especially to harness it from, let's say, a bolt of lightning or something natural, that requires a lot of oral and cultural transmission of hey, this thing's going to strike at this point when the skies get all black. We need to run to it and get that. That's just as much intelligence to me.
Yeah, let alone overcoming our biology to be afraid of fire. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess that's a good point too. That's
like
probably
understanding. Great. Yeah, I don't know, dogs. You know, wolves. I mean, my dog does not like fire, but some dogs are cool with it.
Mine loves fire.
My dog stays about 10 feet away and stare. He also might just overheat because his coat is so thick.
No, mine tries to eat the embers that fly out.
Oh my God, no.
He's got a scar on his nose from it.
No shit, wow.
Well, yeah. Why do you think people are so... I mean, I asked you why they're hellbent on getting a missing link, but why are we so intent on classifying each other into these different little groups and species?
That's what we do, man. And it's unfortunate, but we need to, because the world is complex, we have this need to categorize it and organize it in a way that we can understand. And also we come from an academic tradition and probably even a theological tradition in the West that says that you need to do this. You have this hierarchy, right? And I don't really know if that needs to be the case. As a scientist, I'm interested in cladistics and phylogenetics, right? That's what we do. But at some point, we're going to have a serious rehaul of the way that we, the things that we call, I don't think ergaster, rudolphensis, all these other early members of Homo, I don't actually think they're all their own species at all. You know what I mean?
Lumper.
Sometimes conditionally a lumper, a lot of the times I lump, but then there's some, groups of hominids where I'm it's really tough to lump this, but at the same time, there's good reasons to split. If it means that we can protect an endangered species and split away, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's ecological species concept, biological species concept. I'm a big fan of the conservation species concept. It's if we conserve it, then we're going to split it. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's about all I got for this time. I'd love to have you on again and talk more about this stuff, because it's just endlessly fascinating. Connor and Carlton couldn't make it, but I know they have their own questions about all this stuff too. And you're a guy for that. So
the guy.
Well, if anyone in the audience, if you have any questions regarding human evolution, shoot us a, I'll make a post about this. You can leave a comment or just shoot us a message. We'll see if we can get it answered. But Vincent, I appreciate you coming back on, man.
Don't mention it, buddy.
If you've just listened to episode 148 of Life News Podcast, you can rate and review the podcast on Apple or Spotify. And then rate and review would be great. If you give us a review and send a screenshot of it to the podcast, Carlton will send you a sticker. And Connor's not here, so I don't have a witty joke today. But we'll get back to you next week. All right, see ya.
Thanks for listening to a Life in Ruins podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at a Life in Ruins podcast. And you can also email us at alifeinruinspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, make sure to bring your archaeologists in from the cold and feed them beer. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.